Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Welcome to the Franco Podcast. Welcome to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie Podcast. There are many good reasons to learn a second, third, fourth language. It can positively affect our cognitive abilities, improve our attention and task switching capacities, and slow mental decline as we age. It's even been said to have another language is to possess a second soul. I interviewed 8 bilingual or multilingual people for the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast, including Dr. Claire Marie Brisson. Dr. Brisson is a Franco-Michigander with roots in Metro Detroit and familial connections to Quebec. She's currently the preceptor in French at Harvard University and is the founder and host of the North American Francophone podcast. In our conversation, we discussed her family connections and deep love of language. I learned a little bit about Franco-American history, and we talked about why learning about language is so important. Here's our conversation. Claire Marie, you speak several languages. Can you tell us about your linguistic journey?
Yes, I'd love to. So French is really, I would say, entangled with English, and both languages were spoken at home. So I would say that I grew up in a bilingual environment at home, and I grew up right on the border with Canada. So that also has something to do with my experience having grown up in Michigan. I also speak German. That was my minor in college. And I spoke that at home as well a bit because we had a family connection to Alsace in France. And my great-grandmother spoke German as her first language. So that was carried on down the family line. I speak a little bit of Italian and I read Latin. I started to try to learn ancient Greek, and I'm in the process of learning the Irish language, so Gaelic, as many people would call it, because my mom had part of her family go from Brittany and Normandy in France to Ireland for some time, and I feel a very special connection to that language. I have some proficiency in Arabic because I grew up in Dearborn, Michigan, where Arabic signage is all through the city, and I know at least how to order a coffee and a pastry and to have a little bit of a chit-chat with a friend, but nothing too complex. And I do understand some Spanish, and I can read Russian, but it's really not there. So I live a polyglot experience. I try to learn as much as I can. I know a phrase here and there from other languages, but languages really just revolve around my life, and I love them.
So when did you discover that you loved languages?
I think it was because of where I grew up. I mean, it's really on the border of Canada and the United States, where you have so many communities of languages, so many people who are speaking different languages at home, where you see that signage in my hometown, where you see it in Arabic, where you see it in Spanish. I knew that there was something going on that was beyond just life in English here in the United States and in Canada. And I said, okay, what does that mean for me? And when I was a kid, I used to go to the library and I'd check out books to learn languages. I would check out the Rosetta Stones out of the library and bring them home. And soon the librarians got to know me and they said, wait a minute, you were here a couple weeks ago and you were checking out that thing on Hindi and now you're checking out Japanese. What are you doing? I just had so much interest in language and in the world around me. And even as a child, that was the case. I was the one poring over the illustrated encyclopedias and wanting to know where different people lived, how they lived, what they spoke, how they communicated with one another, and what was important to them.
Were either of your parents like that?
My dad, I think, my mom and my dad really was interested in languages more in the applied sense. He was interested in logic and language. Aristotelian logic, a lot of logical and semiotic ways of using language. So a little bit more of the linguistic side of language. My mom had a dream as a child to be an interpreter for the UN. And she always thought about that. She loved it. She thought it was a great thing to be able to listen to someone and immediately translate. And unfortunately, that never became her ultimate reality. But it was something in her life that motivated her and encouraged her to really mm-hmm. translate experiences. She worked in healthcare, and she often would tell people what was going on with them and translate that into a narrative, into clear language for them. And my grandfather was a translator for the Canadian Army and eventually worked with the American Army as a Canadian. So there was a lot of language going on in my family, too.
Maybe turning for a minute to Franco-American history, for listeners that may be unfamiliar with that, maybe that term and that history, would you mind sketching out a few details for us?
Certainly. So there were a lot of Francophones who came across the border, primarily from Quebec into the United States. And this started really in the 1840s, where there's an industrial revolution in the United States, and many Francophones from Canada just didn't have the same industrial capacity. And so they started coming to the United States because, as they said in French, on a trouvé du pain. So we found bread. We found bread on this side of the border. And so they'd write letters back home, and that would encourage other Francophones to come here. Actually, around 1 million French Canadians came across the border to New England from between 1840 and 1930. And of course, that stops because of the Great Depression. So that traditionally is the term we use. Franco-American is somebody who came across the border that way. But there are plenty of Francophones in the United States, and there really is a debate between the use of Francophone, Franco-American, and how to express our identity here in the United States. So there were Francophones who already lived in places like New York, Washington, D.C., Savannah, Georgia, either by choice or because they were fleeing different parts of North America, like Acadia. And there's also Francophones in Louisiana who came directly either from France or from Acadia. So then there's others like me, the Francophones of the Midwest, who have connections to Canada, who have connections even to New England. And then the Francophones of Western United States and Western Canada, of course, that expansion moved westwards. And we know definitely the history in Manitoba and British Columbia and Alberta. We know that history also in the foundation of Oregon. Actually, the founder of Oregon was a Métis person who spoke French as well as First Nations languages. So this is really the story of North America, but oftentimes we reduce that story to a couple of regions and we say, oh, well, New England historically had Francophones, and it's always a past tense, or, oh, Louisiana had Francophones, but it really is a present tense and a future tense.
Thank you for bringing so many threads together in that. I wasn't clear from my reading if Franco-Americans referred to a particular group of Americans that spoke French or the general thing. And it sounds like that there's some confusion there in general about it.
Yeah, sure. And especially I think there's pride in a good way. There's pride in the community here now I live in New England, and there's pride within that community of that experience where people came across the border and they established themselves in what they called Little Canadas here. So definitely they want to protect that term and they want to protect that history. But at the same time, there are Francophones from sea to sea.
You started your podcast in part because you wanted people to know more about this history. Can you tell me some of the subjects you've touched on so far?
Absolutely. I've talked about everything from cuisine to poetry to cultural activism and a little bit in between. I tried to bring people on the podcast and say, so what links you to the Francophonie? What really brought you within your community to do what you do? And I've had interesting stories where, for example, Joseph Dunn, who's very well known in the community in Louisiana, Joseph Dunn talked about how he speaks a France-style French because his family was directly from France. And at the same time, he recognizes the different forms and variations of French that exist in Louisiana. And we talked about that. My first episode, I talked about how I explored a very old cookbook that came from France to Canada And it was really the first Francophone cookbook or way to explore the culinary environment here in North America, what was available, what was possible. And by way of language, really seeing the environment and where people were with that. I look at history. For example, I talk about the first work of African-American literature was published in French. It's by Victor Séjour, and that was published in Paris, but Victor Séjour was living in Louisiana. So just another example. And I've also invited authors on the podcast, like Pierre Lavoie, who is a Quebecois author who had never translated his work into English, but for the first time, he's there talking about what he did. And he talks about celebrities in New England.
I listened to that. It was a great episode.
A lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
Because I remember just before we recorded, he said, you know, I haven't translated my book. I haven't been able to do this. And now here I am in English. And I said, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. You know, that's exactly what I want to do with this podcast and what I'm going to be doing with more episodes is to bring people into conversation with the English-speaking community.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I consider myself to be fairly well-read, but I didn't know, for example, that Jack Kerouac had a Franco-American background.
It's funny because there's a certain level of, you know, having that experience, knowing that you're a Francophone. He grew up all the way until the age of 6, he was speaking French only at home. And then there's the other experience where you say, wait a minute, okay, so I am Francophone, but I want to share myself with the rest of the world. And especially in the past, French was a language that if you were not publishing, say, for example, in France, maybe it wasn't really looked upon as authentic as much. And that's the sad part about it, is that someone like Kerouac has to write in English and writes in English because there's an authenticity to his American experience if it's told in English. There's also an interesting interview between Kerouac and an interviewer from Radio Canada, where he's sitting in front of a group of people in Montreal, I believe, and the audience is looking at him, and they're all so curious. Why is this man from Massachusetts, from Lowell, Massachusetts, speaking French? And what an interesting accent he has. What a joie this guy has. And they start giggling. I imagine not out of disrespect, but out of just curiosity. Wow, like, we can't believe that this guy is actually continuing to speak French and speaks in such a way and possibly speaks in such a historic or regional way. And it's that interesting transformation where we think about language as being translated across cultural barriers, across geographies, and the personal interactions we have with the language. I think it's just fascinating.
Thank you for doing the podcast. I understand you have a book coming out as well. Do you want to let us know a little bit about what that's going to be about?
Sure. So I'm looking at identity. As we started this discussion, we talked a little bit about that term Franco-American. And I think a lot of people get confused or maybe historically connected to that term and say, okay, well, that was just a group of people who came from primarily Quebec into the United States. But if we look at it, as I mentioned, I love languages. So if we take the tense and we make it present and future, then we can look at what's possible for people who speak French here in North America. And so my book is called Michiganaise, and it might sound like mayonnaise with Michigan, and it should, because mayonnaise is in the style of a region called Mahon. So it was mayonnaise. It was in the style of that region. Well, I'm in the style of Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. So Michiganaise. And I talk about that experience where I was at the confluence between two countries. I was at the intersection of multiple languages. I grew up knowing that my community was interesting and unique and entwined and intertwined within itself and also within all of the people across the world who speak languages that are not connected to one another. Romance languages, not connected to Arabic-based languages, not connected to, I mean, there's so many disconnections and connections in the same space and in the same place. So I really disentangle my experience as a Francophone growing up in Metro Detroit. And I say, well, what is possible for a Francophone in North America today, tomorrow, and beyond? Because there really is, I think, when we think about the community, there's such an attachment to history, which is great. I studied cultural history. I love history. But at the same time, if we don't realize that every moment is living history and we're contributing to history, then we get lost in the facts but can't think about where we're going next. So that's a lot of what I'm doing in that book. I'm resituating the narrative a little bit, and I'm really excited to share that.
What do you love about being multilingual, and do you find anything difficult about it?
Oh, gosh. Well, one thing I love is that I feel ready to communicate with more people than I would if I were, say, for example, only a Francophone or only an Anglophone. I think that speaking English and speaking French, as an example, are two great languages. And I think that Canada is so fortunate to have English and French as official languages. Here in the United States, we don't have an official language. But I think Canada is so fortunate to have those as official languages because you can speak to so many people. And I think that the reason why I want to continue my learning and my study of languages that either have family connections or don't is that I see the world through a different lens. And if you think about photography, if you use different lenses, you can zoom close or you can see far or you can take pictures of people doing sports and capture them as they're running across a field. The same is true for a language. You can really capture different perspectives and see the world in such an illuminating way if you speak another language. Now, a difficulty with that is really translating in real time. Sometimes I'm thinking in French and then I say something in English and I hear myself and it's a direct translation from French. And I say, oh, interesting. That syntax was not English at all. But sometimes I have both languages used in my head in the same sentence and then it comes out as a word jumble. But right. I'd rather have that be a problem than not be able to do it at all. So it's a blessing and sometimes can be a little bit confounding, but it's fine.
I was interested in your one of your podcasts. You said that you your dreams as a child were fragmented in French, English, and German. do you still have dreams like that?
Yes, absolutely, all the time. And what's interesting is many of those dreams, the German is primarily food and cultural items, you know, things that I feel connected to through that Alsatian heritage, foods that my great-grandmother used to cook and then pass down to my grandfather and pass down to my dad and then pass down to me. And then I have French and then I have English. And sometimes it's interesting. My brain comes up with different languages that I can't understand. And then I'm trying to decipher it through the things I know. So a lot of fun play in my dreams with language. And I wish I could share that, too. But, you know, that's a personal cinema. Interestingly enough, German has a great word for that. It's Kopfkino. It means Kopf is head. And Kino means cinema. So it's kind of like you create your own movies in your head. And I guess that's what my dreams are.
Well, so you're an educator. You've started a podcast. You're writing a book. Is there anything else you feel like you'd like to do?
I think that the next step is really to get engaged with governments, with schools, with people who are really and truly trying to do the same things, but in different realms. And I've started to do a little bit of that work, but I feel like there's so much more to do. And obviously, I'm only one person, but to speak a little bit more with who is learning French? What does learning French look like? What does learning French look like, particularly here in the United States? And I know that sadly, we're facing so many cuts of language learning here in the United States. The humanities often are on the chopping block of many high schools or colleges even. And that's very sad to me. And I think dialoguing with school boards and universities and high schools and maybe giving some talks or at least chatting a little bit and saying, you know, here's why languages are important. Here's why French is a gateway to our neighbors to the north in Canada. Here's why French is a gateway to the Francophonie, 88 countries or 88 mm-hmm. member states that speak French. So it's a challenge, it's a battle, but it's something that I'd like to include. And then I also would like to escape a little bit just from being so language-based and really think about what are cultures doing in general? What does it mean to be proud of a language or to study a language or to think about where we are in the world today, since we're so connected, right? We're talking to one another right now across such a distance. And yet it seems like we're in the same room sharing a coffee together. You know, this is the incredible thing about the internet that we often forget. And really thinking and having conversations with communities broadly outside of a similar or shared language and say, what does it mean that we've been connected to one another for 35 plus years using this type of technology? And how can we understand languages combined together, not as so separate as we often have done through linguistics, but where are we going with language? What does communication look like now today in the 21st century? And having conversations with historians, linguists, people who are not part of the academy. I often think we are always seen to be in the ivory tower being professors, but I think that that's the worst place to be to really learn.
That was my conversation with Claire Marie Brisson, who teaches French at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and hosts the North American Francophone podcast. Claire Marie's book, Michiganaise, will be out in 2025. This year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie partners and funders include the Government of Canada, the Linguistic Portal of Canada, the National Film Board, Air Canada, La Fédération de la Jeunesse Canadienne Française, NAV Canada, and many other groups, including the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Dreaming in pearly whites, I'll never let you down.
You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang out with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions.
Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Welcome to the Franco Podcast.
Welcome to the 2024 Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast. There are many good reasons to learn a second, third, or fourth language. It can positively affect our cognitive abilities, improve our attention and task switching capacities, and slow mental decline as we age. It's even been said that to have another language is to possess a second soul. I interviewed 8 bilingual or multilingual people for this year's Rendezvous de la Francophonie podcast, including Ness Benamran. Ness lives in the West Kootenay region of BC, but has roots in France, England, and Cyprus, and familial connections to Mauritius. He is a senior manager at a BC nonprofit and a former volunteer programmer and board member at Kootenay Co-op Radio in Nelson. Ness plays drums with a 4-piece alt soul group called Penny Shades. In our conversation, we discussed his shifting connections to language and home, learning and relearning languages, and the difficulty of keeping connected with his languages while living in a primarily English-speaking area. Here is our conversation. You speak several languages. Can you tell me about your linguistic journey?
Well, I was born in France. So the first language I spoke was French. And then my mom and I left France when I was 3 years old and moved to the UK. That's where my mom is originally from. She was born in Mauritius but raised in London. I learned English when we moved to the UK and forgot my French. My mom says that I rejected speaking French because I was outed in school a lot for kindergarten for being the French kid. And then we met my dad, my stepfather, who I call my dad, after all these years. And he was also raised in London, but he's Greek Cypriot. So we lived with him for 2-3 years in London. And then we all moved to Cyprus. And that's where I spent most of my childhood. I didn't leave Cyprus until after high school. And in Cyprus, I went to public school there and grew up speaking Greek and spoke English at home with my mom, spoke Greek and a bit of English with my dad, and then Greek, of course, in school and with all my friends. And then when high school was done, I left home. I moved back to France for a few years. And part of the reason was because I wanted to relearn French. And then after France, I started just drifting around in my 20s. I lived in Australia for a year and backpacked around Asia for a year and then lived in Barcelona for a year. And I got to learn Spanish there. And then in Barcelona, I met someone from Canada, and that's how my whole getting to know Canada and then move to Canada and then move here to immigrate, that's where that whole journey started. I didn't actually realize I was going to live here. Like, it was kind of a last minute decision when the person who I'd met in Barcelona was moving back, and I was like, well, maybe I'll just come with you and check it out for a few months. Like, at the time, I had no idea it was going to turn into the place that I would, raise my own child, as it turns out. So I've been living in the Kootenays for the last 16 plus years. And yeah, this is definitely the longest I've been in one place at any point in my life. And also where I haven't had the chance to use any of the languages that I've spoke throughout my life before moving here, which has made all of them really rusty.
Actually, I have a question about Cyprus for you. Mm. Or what are the common languages in Cyprus?
Cyprus has 3 official languages. When it gained independence from the British in 1960, the government that was set up was made up of Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots and chose to have English as a 3rd official language. It's quite common for Cypriots to speak English. A huge percentage of the economy also relies on tourism, so there's a lot of interaction with English-speaking folks. But the other 2 languages, Greek and Turkish, tend to be somewhat segregated. Turkish Cypriots that live in the and Greek is spoken predominantly in the south.
So you didn't have an opportunity to learn Turkish, for example?
No. And in fact, because of, you know, centuries-long conflict between Turkish people and Greek folks, there's no encouragement to engage with, you know, Turkish culture at all in the Greek